From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we take a look at the secret military forces fighting today's covert battles. James Adams has written a new book comparing these special forces of America, Europe, and the Soviet Union. Adams is the defense correspondent of the Sunday Times of London. Also today, I speak with Kate Clinton. She's a stand-up comic whose punchlines have a lesbian feminist spin. We have a review of a new TV series set in Vietnam called China Beach, and a remembrance of Gil Evans, the late jazz arranger and bandleader. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. All the major military powers of the East and West have secret armies. The United States has Delta Force, England has the Special Air Service, and the Soviet Union has Spetsnaz. These special forces are used to conduct covert military operations out of the public eye. They can be deployed to overthrow a government, stop a third world revolution, or assassinate an enemy leader. It's these same special forces that are called on to rescue civilians from terrorists. James Adams' new book, Secret Armies, is a study of Soviet, European, and American special forces. Adams is the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. He's also the author of Financing Terror. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked Adams more specifically what kinds of jobs special forces are deployed for.
In peacetime, mostly, therefore, used either for training foreign armies that wish to have similar types of forces, or for gathering reconnaissance information that would be used in wartime, or for countering terrorism, both in terms of gathering intelligence and in let's say, rescuing hostages held on board an aircraft.
Let's talk about some of the recent ways that special forces have been deployed. Last week, for instance, the assassination of PLO leader Abu Jihad. Now, that was special forces from Israel.
Yes, indeed. A classic operation of its kind. They deployed secretly. They were controlled by an aircraft flying overhead. They sent ashore an advanced intelligence gathering unit, and then the assassination squad followed shortly thereafter, and they all, as we know, managed to get away successfully. So that was an assassination unit sent in specifically to do a job. But Israel is unusual in that it is one of the very few countries in the world that does that specific kind of very ruthless assassination.
Now, there was the Kuwaiti airliner that was hijacked, and that was a long siege of that airliner, yet there were no special forces that came to surround it or to try to free the hostages. Why do you think special forces were not used in that instance?
Well, that hijacking was very interesting because it was the first of its type to demonstrate the really sophisticated level that terrorists have reached now. And I think there's been a common perception that in Mogadishu, where the German special forces went in to rescue terrorists some years ago, it could be repeated again and again, where we could just go in and everyone would be rescued, the terrorists would be killed, and it would all be fine. Those days are long gone. And the terrorists now, particularly those terrorists that were involved in the Kuwaiti hijacking, are very sophisticated. They captured a bit ago the CIA station chief in Beirut, William Buckley, tortured him, gathered a lot of intelligence, and have used that very effectively. And both the American Delta Force and the British SAS were consulted when the Kuwaiti aircraft was hijacked and were asked, well, can you go in? Can you take the aircraft down? And both of them said, well, yes, we can do it, but it'll be a bloodbath, and we do not recommend that we take that choice. So it is a different world now. Aircraft hijacking is difficult to combat.
What is the information that the terrorists got that made them invulnerable to special forces?
I think it didn't make them invulnerable. It just made the special forces' job much more difficult. And what they gathered was the chain of command, what triggers off the reaction in the West. So and then how much time do special forces need? So you'll see in hijacks, for example, that they move around a lot now, that they know how we gather intelligence inside the aircraft. So they move the passengers around. So it's difficult to pinpoint so that to locate where the passengers are at any one time so that you know where to enter and where the terrorists are. They know what kind of weapons we have. All of those sort of things have limited the options available to special forces and made taking out an aircraft exceptionally difficult. The elements of speed, surprise, and intelligence that are essential for an effective counter-hijack have now not disappeared, but certainly been made a lot more elusive.
My guest is James Adams. He's the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and author of the new book Secret Armies, which is about special forces in European countries, America, and the Soviet Union. Let's talk about the American special forces, Delta Force. Now, American special forces were used in the failed attempt to rescue the Iranian hostages a few years ago. Special forces were used in the invasion of Grenada. Other recent ways American special forces were used?
Well, they were used also to take out the terrorists who were on board the liner, the Achille Lara. They've been deployed at various occasions to try and do things, but have never actually gone in and done anything, because the political decision-making has been too slow or the incident itself has been resolved. They are very eager to prove themselves because their reputation is lots of technology but not much technique. And so they're anxious to prove themselves, but the opportunity hasn't yet arisen, apart from Grenada, which was, in many respects, a failure.
Now, don't you say in your book that the Delta Force is still officially a secret?
Yes, it is. I mean, the presence of Delta Force is neither confirmed nor denied whenever they are deployed. And their techniques, their training, their tactics, their weapons are all kept secret, as indeed they should be. I mean, a lot of these things shouldn't be revealed because, as we've seen with the Kuwaiti hijack, all that happens then is that the people they are trying to deal with adapt their own techniques in turn. So their existence is now acknowledged, but beyond that, not much at all.
What's funny about acknowledging their existence, there was a 1986 Chuck Norris film called The Delta Force.
Yes, absolutely right.
Hard to keep this a secret. Now, how are they trained? How are the members of the Delta Force trained?
Well, they have... The recruiting places an emphasis on initiative, strength to some extent, resilience, endurance, but primarily initiative, because you're having to operate outside of the normal chains of command, and you need to be both an individual and a team player, which is often an unusual combination. They have wide training in a number of different weapon systems, both in their own armed forces and those for other countries, both East and West. And then they have very specific training on rescuing people from buildings, rescuing people from aircraft.
Where are those scenarios played out so that they have practice in hypothetical hostage situations and terrorist situations?
Their base is down in Fort Bragg in North Carolina, and that's where, in and around that area, which is a huge base, they practice all that kind of thing. And are believed to be extremely good at what they do, although other special forces, and there is a great deal of national rivalry, obviously, say that Delta is... places rather too much emphasis on high tech and muscle and not enough on brains.
Now, as you point out in your book, Grenada was the first time that all the parts of the armed forces and the special forces were deployed since the war in Vietnam. And you think that Grenada militarily was a terrible failure.
I think it was. I think it didn't... It has been billed subsequently as a great military success. But for those that took part, I think it was less so. At the outset, the intelligence was very inadequate. The CIA, despite having run a propaganda campaign against Grenada for some years, had no assets on the island at all. The mission allegedly was to rescue American medical students on the island, but no one knew where they were. The command and control was very vague. Far too many people were involved. There was no need to have Marines, Rangers, Delta, the SEALs, the Navy, the Air Force. Everyone that could possibly get in on the act did so. And all of that led to a great deal of confusion. Much of the equipment didn't work. The radios between different groups didn't communicate properly, and so on. It was all the way down the line, there were a great number of difficulties. And a lot of those are necessary. If the lessons of the failure of Delta Force at Desert One in Iran had been learned, then perhaps Grenada would have been a more efficient operation. But there doesn't seem to be a willingness to learn from the past.
What's one of the lessons that you think the United States should have learned from the failed invasion of Iran to try to get the hostages?
I think one of the, perhaps the most important, is that command and control should be clean. So there is a Special Forces maxim, which is known by the acronym of KISS, which is Keep It Simple, Stupid, and is a sort of byword of how to do special operations. And Desert One was extremely complicated. There were dozens of passwords. The people didn't train together. There was all sorts of different people in charge, and it was all very confused. And if you have a clean chain of command where one goes to another, where it's very simple, then there is a much greater chance of success. You have greater flexibility. You can adapt to the circumstances that always are different on the ground than from the plan. But that doesn't seem to be a hallmark of U.S. operations, which do tend to be very overcomplicated.
You draw the conclusion in your book that the United States still doesn't understand how to deal with terrorism or unconventional warfare.
I think that's right. There are the need or the primary requirement for that kind of operation, as opposed to the intelligence gathering, but the action part of it, is to keep it small, keep it simple, and keep the command clear. And in every instance where it's happened in the past, all those things have become very confused. America's natural tendency, because it's a very big country with a very powerful and effective armed force, when used as a monolith, is to employ mass. And what you need often in small operations, by their very nature, they're tight, they're clean, they should be, you should use precise force, is not to use the limited numbers of force, but instead to put in great amounts of firepower and muscle, and that actually has a diminishing effect.
Let's compare the United States Special Forces with the Soviet Special Forces, known as Spetsnaz. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, Spetsnaz. Yes, absolutely.
Now, you say that the Soviets actually have a plan for using their special forces to invade and disable NATO countries if there's a war.
Yes, we I have to say, have the same sort of plan, too. But the Soviets would aim to infiltrate their special forces behind our lines, either dressed as in the uniform of other countries. So, for example, if Spetsnaz came into Britain, they might perhaps be dressed as Americans or French or whatever. So they might speak with a funny accent, but the Brits might think it was just a foreign funny accent, not a Russian funny accent. And they would carry out reconnaissance, sabotage, some assassination. They would try to disrupt communications, the chain of command, particularly the nuclear chain of command. And they'd do the same thing in the United States. So they would be in a time of tension just before war breaks out. Spetsnaz would come in and with the aim of disrupting the normal progression of the military as it got itself geared up for war. And I think they'd be quite effective too.
This is actually a procedure that the Soviets have already used, having the Spetsnaz infiltrate a country before the war or before the invasion actually starts.
Yes, that's absolutely right. In both the Czechoslovak invasion and in the invasion of Afghanistan, Spetsnaz went in first, and they used the same techniques very effectively. They activated their agents inside the country first, and who were provided good information. Then they infiltrated their own forces dressed in the forces of the country where they had to operate. And in the case of Czechoslovakia, they kidnapped the whole cabinet of the Czech government, including Alexander Dubček, and took them back to Moscow. In the case of Afghanistan, they managed to activate their agents so that the Afghan leaders were all at a cocktail party, the military leaders were all at a cocktail party, the president's palace was taken, the president assassinated, key points taken, the radio station and so on. And they made the invasion itself very much easier. They were very effective on both occasions. And I think there's a lesson in that for the West, that we should learn that that special forces can play a vital role and that they are very important. And the conventional military should recognize that and embrace them rather than resent them as they do at the moment.
I want to get back to something you said before. You said that the Soviets have this plan of invading NATO countries with their special forces. And you said that the United States and, I guess, NATO countries have a similar plan as well. Are Are the NATO countries and the Soviet Union aware of each other's plans, and do they have special forces ways of counteracting the opposing special forces if they've infiltrated?
Well, yes, I suppose it's all a game of chess, really. Yes, we are aware of the plans, some of the plans that they have, and they, I'm sure, are aware of some of ours. How effectively we will counter it is a pretty problematic, I think. There is some practices done in the United States for dealing with Spetsnaz, but the awareness of the civil defense units in the United States, of the military generally, I think is fairly low. In Britain, too, other European countries, Spetsnaz would be pretty effective. In the Soviet Union or in Poland or Czechoslovakia, where we would be operating, I doubt that any of the people there have any idea that that the SAS or that other American units might pop up behind their lines and start taking them out. I shouldn't think they even know we exist.
How would you compare the training of the Soviet special forces to the training of America's special forces?
Well, the Soviets have been deploying Spetsnaz a great deal in Afghanistan. There's been 4,000 or 5,000 of them there at any one time for several years now. And we've had an opportunity to observe them very extensively. Their training, the Soviet army is conscript, so they're rather different from our volunteer armies. And that has its drawbacks as to begin with. But they do get training in special equipment, special exercises, and they have rather higher caliber officers than the other parts of the armed forces, just like we do. And the difference between them and us, I think the most important difference, is that they do seem to be deployed in rather larger numbers, 50 rather than 16 in the case of the Brits. And that is a significant difference, because the bigger the numbers, the more easy you are to detect. And they don't seem to be quite as fluid and as flexible to demonstrate as so much initiative as we do. But we have a lot of respect for them. But it's not to say that they're all 10 feet tall and one of them can take out 500 of us, because it's not really like that at all.
From your book, it seems that both the Soviet and the American special forces are trained to survive under very difficult situations, and trained also to travel with very little food. In a Green Berets manual, it suggests foraging for food by finding large anthills and first of all looking for scraps of food that the ants have collected, and if that doesn't work, cooking the ants for 6 minutes and killing off the poisons that the ants might have and eating the ants.
Well, people tell me that ants are absolutely delicious. It's not something I have to say that I intend trying myself, but nonetheless, I think the U.S. Special Forces are, after all, known as the snake eaters, and that comes from the fact that when they used to demonstrate their technique, they would capture skin and roast a snake and then eat it. So part of this, of course, is all macho, but part of it is real. You do have to live off the land, and you can't just take along your ribeye steak and stick it on a fire and it's all going to be terrific. You've just got to forage and live where you can.
Well, before we talk more, we're going to have to take a short break. My guest is James Adams. He's the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London. His new book, Secret Armies, looks into the covert special forces trained specifically to counter revolution and guerrilla warfare. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
James Adams is my guest, author of the new book, Secret Armies, about special forces in America, Europe, and the Soviet Union. Well, you've rated the American special forces as not being quite up to snuff, not really delivering. And you've rated the Soviet special forces, I think, as being pretty good, pretty well trained, very effective when deployed. What about in your country, in England?
Well, I think, and you'll think this is chauvinist of me, but it's not really. I think we, the British, have had more experience than any other country in fighting terrorism, first of all, and, of course, in warfare, too, because the Brits founded the SAS in the Second World War, and then they deployed them in Malaysia in a campaign against communist insurgents there, then in Aden in the same thing, and then Oman in the same thing, and more recently in the Falklands War. And then in the counter-terrorist role, they've been operating in Northern Ireland for a long time. So We do have a great deal of experience in this area, and I think the SAS has proved itself to be very effective. But the key to all successful special forces is that they adapt to new circumstances, and whether we can be as sanguine about the SAS in 15 or 20 years' time, I don't know. But today, I think they're the best around.
You write that the special forces are really a response to changing styles of warfare. What kinds of changes are the special forces a response to?
Well, I think in the Second World War was really the key when the nuclear weapons were developed, and then with the superpower race, the nuclear race, that made conventional war, the way you get massed armies meeting on the battlefield to achieve territorial or political advantage, that made it very risky because there was always the danger of nuclear escalation. So everyone was reluctant to fight those kinds of wars, and indeed there really hasn't been any for quite some time now. So if you don't take away national ambition, all you do is take away a method of fighting war. So the result has been a resurgence or an emergence of guerrilla warfare, what's become known as low-intensity conflict, which at the lowest level, I suppose, you have terrorism, and then you move up to regular guerrilla warfare. And that has in turn bred all these special forces, either made by governments or sponsored by governments, and that's become the way of fighting war. And it is a new warfare, and you've had new people to meet the challenge.
And as you point out, you don't need a state-sponsored military to supply you mass-produced cheap arms like automatic rifles and bombs and grenades.
No, all of that stuff is readily available. And if you look at the 40-odd wars that are going on around the world at the moment, all of them have a hand of a bigger military power lurking in the background somewhere. And all of them have ready access to guns and cash and arms of one kind or another. And using the trickle-down theory of economics, there is a trickle-down theory of arms, too, that a big country gets one, and 20 years later it's reached the littlest country.
Whose command in America is Delta Force under now?
Delta Force comes under something called the Special Operations Command, which is a new structure that was set up under the Reagan administration, which has placed a great deal of emphasis on improving and enhancing special forces. And SOCOM reports up to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and then in turn to the White House. So it's a new command, but is not been very welcome by the conventional military, and there have been all sorts of trouble about setting it up, staffing it, getting the right people in.
Well, has the conventional military in America resisted special forces?
Yes, I think so, because there is always an element of resistance, and it seems to be particularly so here. The U.S.'s military is an enormous bureaucracy, and there is a way of doing things. There is a way of getting your ticket punched and moving up the system. The special forces, by their nature, are special. They're outside the traditional way of doing things. They operate in secret. The people that are recruited are often the best people from different branches of the military, so are resented because of that. And there is a lot of resistance to it. They're the glory boys. Why should they get it all when we get nothing? Why should they get all the kit when we don't get it? And so on. So there is a residual resentment, which is unfortunate, I think. But that is common in every country, that you always get that. But America is a bigger country than everyone else, and so the resentment perhaps is bigger.
Let me get back to what you were just saying. You were pointing out that these special forces are really a reaction to the growing number of terrorist acts and of guerrilla warfare, of revolutions. The special forces are largely doing secret operations, fighting in covert operations. And the question arises, how secret should the secret forces be? I think especially in a country like the United States, in which there's been so much controversy surrounding some of our recent covert operations.
Yes, I sometimes despair of the U.S. In this area, because there is this ambivalence that seems to be a hallmark of all covert operations of, yes, well, we should do it, and yes, they should be secret, which is clearly right. You should do covert operations, and you should keep them covert, because there's no point in announcing them, because then they defeat the object of the exercise. But the reason why there is so much reticence about it here is the history, where there has been consistent abuses of authority. In Delta Force, there's been a whole sorts of scandals about corruption and money being siphoned off and so on. And then they don't seem to work very well. So all of those things have built up to a lot of congressional oversight, a lot of interference, which undermines the effectiveness. And if you look at the other special forces, if you look at the SAS, for example, there isn't that kind of oversight. There isn't the problems, or at least they've never emerged, the problems of corruption, of abuse of privilege, abuse of power. And instead, they just quietly get on with their job, and one never hears really very much about it at all, and quite rightly so. But the balance hasn't yet been reached here, where you have the covert operations, which are effective, but without the abuse of power. And I don't know how to reach that balance. Get a better caliber of people involved so that they take their responsibilities more seriously, perhaps. I don't know.
You have an awful lot of interesting information in your book, and I don't know if any of this was previously secret or not, but how do you go about finding out the plans of basically secret operations?
Well, obviously, I have touched only a small percentage, I'm sure, of what really goes on. And some of the things one knows, one doesn't tell anyway, because they might be helpful to people who one wouldn't wish to help. But there are a lot of people who want to give guidance, want to help you along in some way if you're trying to present a whole picture. And it is in people's interests, I think, to try and get the facts accurate rather than get them inaccurate.
One last question. Here we are in this situation of a new kind of warfare, the low-intensity conflict, the guerrilla warfare, warfare being waged through terrorist and counter-terrorist acts, and a lot of these wars being fought by these special services, these secret armies. Now, on the other hand, we haven't had a world war since the 1940s. There hasn't been a nuclear conflict since the 1940s. Do you think that this is the right direction to be heading in? Not that anyone's deciding whether it's right or wrong or not, but do you think that these kinds of wars are ultimately more dangerous, or that, you know, we should be thankful that there's these low-level conflicts instead of a larger confrontation?
I think absolutely it is far better to have a whole number of little wars, safety valves, if you like, that blow off around the world, than you have one big confrontation. You have that one big confrontation, and there'll none of us be left to talk about it. And I would far... all wars are unsatisfactory, clearly, but if you're going to have them at all, and I think we have to accept they'll be around for as long as one can see, then better that they're little, that they're fought by special forces, that they keep the lid on and keep the safety valve blowing just a little bit here and there, so that we don't have the worldwide conflagration that we all want to avoid.
But there's always something so deceiving about it. It appears that we're at peace when there's, in fact, low-intensity conflicts being fought around the world.
Yes, and of course, if you're in the middle of one of those low-intensity conflicts, they appear fairly high-intensity conflict. But yes, I mean, as I say, there are 40 wars going on at the moment, and they are very expensive in both life and economic cost. But wars are part of modern society, I'm afraid, and they'll be with us forever.
James Adams, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been James Adams. He's the defense correspondent for the Sunday Times of London and the author of the new book, Secret Armies Inside the American, Soviet, and European Special Forces. It's published by the Atlantic Monthly Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with New York Times reporter Nan Robertson. Her new book, Getting Better, is a behind-the-scenes look at Alcoholics Anonymous. She's part of the story. AA helped her give up drinking. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. So, what's so funny about being a lesbian and a feminist? Coming up, we speak with stand-up comic Kate Clinton. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead remembers one of jazz's greatest arrangers, the late Gil Evans. And television critic David Bianculli reviews China Beach, ABC's new series about the American women who served during the war in Vietnam. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. More than 45 years after he operated gas chambers at the Treblinka concentration camp, and 14 months after he was brought to trial, former Cleveland auto worker John Demjanjuk was sentenced to death today by an Israeli court. Last week, the same court had found him guilty of war crimes. Jim Letterman reports.
Demjanjuk has 45 days to appeal the verdict and the sentence, and his lawyers say that they will appeal. Throughout the hearings, and even as he was led away today to his cell, Demjanjuk has claimed that his is a case of mistaken identity. He continues to protest his innocence, that he is not the man his accusers call Ivan the Terrible, the man who operated the gas chambers at a Treblinka concentration camp. The court today found otherwise. 1,000 deaths would not be an adequate penalty for what he has done, the court declared. The court accepted eyewitness testimony that Demjanjuk had personally beaten, smashed in the skulls, and mutilated the bodies of inmates at Treblinka. And he had operated the gas chambers with a pleasure and industriousness that went beyond the orders he had been given. Altogether, the court found him guilty in the killing of 870,000 people in 1 year. If his appeal and his petition for clemency to the president fail, he will be only the third person to have been hanged in Israeli history. In Jerusalem, I'm Jim Letterman.
Also in Israel today, the authorities took steps to control commercial activity in East Jerusalem. For the past 5 months, shop owners have carried on a strike in sympathy with the Palestinian uprising. NPR's John Hockenberry reports.
Shop owners defied the army and remained closed during normal business hours today. The Arab shop owners had been opening only during the hours of 2 to 5 in the afternoon, according to directives from the leaders of the Palestinian uprising. Today, the Israeli authorities said shop owners who didn't open in the morning would have to remain closed all day. 14 arrests were made. Shops were forcibly locked and keys were confiscated. The Israeli orders were enforced with hundreds of riot police and a water cannon, which was briefly turned on the peaceful crowd. This is the first action taken against Arab shop owners in East Jerusalem. Much harsher measures are common in the West Bank and Gaza. I'm John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
A teachers' union gave Education Secretary William Bennett's report on education a failing grade today. The National Education Association said the report released today absolved the federal government from any responsibility when it proclaimed that American education is now doing better but not well enough. The report released today was called American Education, Making It Work. It was a follow-up to a study done 5 years ago. That study was called A Nation at Risk. A study released today by the Environmental Defense Fund suggests that common forms of air pollution are contributing to severe water pollution. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports.
The new study suggests that nitrogen compounds coming out of automobile tailpipes and out of coal-burning power plant smokestacks are falling with the rain into estuaries and bays along the Atlantic coast and touching off a biological chain reaction that's killing fish and plants in the Chesapeake Bay. Researchers have known for years that nitrogen pollution can be deadly to marine life. Nitrogen compounds encourage the growth of harmful algae, which suck precious oxygen out of the water. But until now, government officials have figured they can pretty much solve the problem by controlling nitrogen pollution on the ground, especially nitrogen washing out of farm fertilizer and out of sewage treatment plants. To the contrary, the new study suggests government officials won't solve the nitrogen problem in the Chesapeake and other bays unless they control air pollution, too. Environmental Defense Fund researchers say, according to their calculations, air pollution contributes at least 25% of the nitrogen pollution damaging the bays. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Washington.
There was a strong showing on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 22 points, closing at 2037.30. Advances led declines 8-5 in trading of 157 million shares. The average price of a share gained 26 cents. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new reissue featuring the late pianist, bandleader, and arranger Gil Evans. Evans first attracted notice writing for Claude Thornhill's big band in the 1940s. In 1949, Evans was a key participant in trumpeter Miles Davis's Birth of the Cool sessions. Later, he championed the music of Jimi Hendrix. This reissue features the sound of Evans in the early 60s.
Evans' final years happily contradicted the rule that great artists get their due only when they're dead. By the time Evans died on March 20th, record companies, critics, and club owners had all caught on. But if you want to know why Evans was branded the greatest jazz arranger, the one who elevated arranging to the art of recomposition, the place to start is his greatest period from 1957 to 1964. During that time, he arranged four albums for Miles Davis and recorded five of his own, including the all-time classic Out of the Cool. A month before Evans' death, Verve reissued on CD a new and improved edition of his last album from those peak years, The Individualism of Gil Evans, recorded in 1963 and 4. Here's an excerpt from Time of the Barracudas with Wayne Shorter on tenor sax. Evans had a habit of taking ideas other musicians were using and making virtues out of their shortcomings. In the 70s, he'd make good use of dreaded synthesizer and funk bass. But in the early 60s, he'd been thinking about his friends Miles Davis and Claude Thornhill. Davis had popularized the movement away from soloing over intricate chord sequences. Now, players would improvise on a single mode or scale for as long as they liked. But the drawback to modal jazz is that it often lacks a sense of forward motion. Evans had faced a similar problem arranging for Claude Thornhill in the 40s. He loved the Thornhill band's delicate orchestral textures, the chords that hung like a cloud, as Evans liked to say. But he'd found Thornhill's snowfall charts rather static. When Evans sat down to write his own stretched-out music, his solution to Davis's and Thornhill's problems was to combine their approaches. He'd back modal solos with gorgeously billowing chords, but would also keep the instruments moving within the dense harmonies. Imagine you're looking out the window of a plane flying through a cloud bank.
Sometimes you get a glimpse of the world outside. Sometimes it's all a big blur. Sometimes you notice the changing texture of the cloud itself. Listen to the beginning of Gil Evans' Proclamation. Gil Evans' best music continues to amaze me. It's been said that when pretty French harmonies entered jazz, the music lost its momentum. Before that, the emphasis was on swinging from one place to the next. Afterwards, the pretty place itself became enough. Evans personified that shift, yet for all his tendency to write him slow and pretty, with the improvised parts almost an afterthought, no one questions his identity as a jazz man. His blues don't sound like anyone else's, but you always know they're the blues. When you think about what Gil Evans accomplished, it seems impossible. And yet in those great old days, he seemed to do it every time.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the individual of Gil Evans, a reissue on the Verve label. This is Fresh Air. My guest is stand-up comic Kate Clinton. Her humor is about being a lesbian and a feminist in a heterosexual world. Kate's talent was nurtured coming up through the ranks of the women's movement, playing at women's festivals and conferences. Now she's one of the few openly gay comics who's broken into the comedy circuit. Kate's first audiences were her students during the 8 years she taught high school English. Now in her routines, Kate Clinton talks about issues that no one else does.
Now, when I was in second grade, it seemed like a lot of my friends were terribly worried, very, very worried about the fifth commandment. I was not worried about the fifth commandment. The most terrifying commandment I ever heard was good old number 9. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. I heard that commandment, and I thought it had my name on it.
A lot of times what is the mainstream of comedy is essentially the men's experience. I think a lot of times women are just surprised to hear somebody talking about things that we go through. I just turned 40, and I've started to talk about it, And there's a laugh of recognition, almost a relief that women are going to hear somebody talking about getting older without talking about, you know, body parts falling off or sagging down or any of that. I think it's a great resource. I think that, you know, Bill Cosby, every time he gets a wrinkle, he writes a book about it. And I think that women don't hear enough about women getting older in a positive way.
Another subject that you cover that really nobody else does. You talk about how absurd you find the emphasis on phallus size in gay male classified ads.
Yes, and I think it's hysterical because women in women's papers, we don't we're not size queens anyway. And I was in Provincetown this summer, and it was really quite an education for me in terms of gay culture. I've known about feminist culture and lesbian culture for a long time, but it was really my first experience in gay culture. So, I mean, the concept of I don't understand female impersonation. And so being there was just, it was very, very interesting to me. To me, it's like the thrill of, I guess, dressing up like Perry Como and wearing a big pair of boxer shorts and doing some of his old tunes. And I didn't understand it. And I was asked to judge a drag show. Now, the point of a drag show is you go in and the guys are, they dress up in, you know, to do the woman perfectly that they're impersonating, and they wear the exact same clothes, they make the same movements, they do the same songs. But then they would come out and they said, we want you to judge this drag show, but we want you to judge it on originality. And I could not figure out what was original here.
You've said that as a feminist comic, that you promised yourself that you wouldn't make fun of other women, but on the other hand, some women are just too tempting.
Too tempting.
Did you really, though, make that kind of pact with yourself, that as a feminist comic you shouldn't mock other women?
I think that women are warned about humor. I think, certainly when I was growing up, you weren't allowed to make fun of boys. And so you learned a kind of horizontal kind of humor where you'd make fun of other women or of yourself. I think that's what is rewarded still very much in the mainstream culture, is that women make fun of other women. And so I really try not to, although it is very tempting. some women are just kind of, yeah, you do have to talk about them. But I did make that pact with myself, certainly that I wouldn't make fun of myself, and certainly that I wouldn't really, you know, as a career move, make fun of other women.
I bet there's a lot of women comics who are lesbians but who aren't out publicly. They're not out in the entertainment world. And they probably really wish that they could do the kind of material that you could do.
And I think that I have come up in it through a different system. I came up really through the women's music system. And there's a really well-developed network of what we call women's music. So I was able to perform at colleges and to perform at conferences, and a different kind of thing than a comedy club. I think comedy clubs now are very, very difficult and quite misogynist places for women to do their work. And I think that women who even talk about sexuality in comedy clubs have a difficult time, if it's not about dating.
You got started playing to women audiences
on
the women's music circuit and at women's festivals, at women's studies conferences. And a lot of those audiences, first of all, there's no men who are there for the conference. Second of all, there's been a lot of exclusive concerts where men really are not invited. But what was it like for you when you started to play to audiences in which there were men present? Were you prepared for that?
I think when I first thought about performing to a more mixed audience, I was kind of concerned. And then, you know, then I thought, God, I taught high school English for 8 years, and that certainly was a mixed audience. And they, you know, they listened. And I really felt that, you know, it was certainly a political decision. And I really felt that it was important to say that I was a feminist comedian, mostly. And you wouldn't believe that people really like to talk to me because they can't believe that those two things go together. You know, feminist and humorist. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
You know, it's a political decision. I made it. And in fact, what's happened is that the audiences are widening. And I think it's what I believe about feminism, and is that it's a very inclusive concept.
You're breaking into, quote, mainstream comedy clubs now. And you're breaking into the comedy circuit. Comedy is in some ways almost like a men's fraternity. There aren't that many women who've really made it to the top. And I can't think of a whole lot of lesbian feminist comics who have made it to the top.
Right.
Now, you probably hear a lot of really offensive routines in the comedy clubs. If you hear a man who's doing something you find really offensive, do you say something or do you just let it go? What do you do?
Well, I have found that hissing is very good. And because what you do is you destroy a kind of a rhythm that the person has with that particular line, and that person never does that line again with any kind of confidence. I have encouraged people to do that. It's very interesting when it comes back on you, but I generally try to talk to people, you know, if there's any hope at all, or if I, you know, I feel that the energy isn't completely wasted, talking to them about what I find, that it's really difficult for me to hear that part.
Can your family deal with you being a public lesbian? Since you're a lesbian in your professional work, you know, it's everyone who sees your act or hears your records knows that you are. Can your family cope with that? Do they ever have problems with it?
I think they had problems in the beginning. We're kind of a quiet family. Kind of a raised eyebrow.
They are,
an
you're
overstatement.
Not.
In my family, I think my dad would prefer if I, you know, I said, Dad, wouldn't you like to come to a show? And he's just not ready yet. He thinks maybe he'd go in Portland, Oregon. You know, he lives in Syracuse, New York, but they're doing well. They're proud of me.
In your routines, you describe yourself as a recovering Catholic. Did you go through a long period of guilt for being a lesbian?
You know, I actually went through a longer period of guilt for not being a Catholic, even when I was trying to be one. And because I wasn't real strong in those beliefs, I think it was easier for me to come to terms with being a lesbian than other Catholic women.
Have you done any television yet?
I've done a couple of things. I did a show called Comedy Tonight for KQED, and I did a show in Canada out of Toronto.
What do you think the chances are that you would be allowed to break into the TV comedy circuit?
I don't know. You know, I think that there's a kind of homogeneity about comedy right now because everyone is trying to make their routines go into 6 perfect minutes for David Letterman or for Johnny Carson, and they're not so topical because they need to be able to be played in reruns. I don't know, but I think that what I'm thinking is that it's a kind of a gimmick that certainly no one else is talking about, and if someone courageous or interested in putting their career on the line, heard me, I think that is a possibility of breaking into TV comedy.
You're performing to different kinds of audiences now. You perform to lesbian audiences, to feminist audiences, and also to mixed audiences and straight audiences. Do you find yourself doing different material depending on who the audience is? And do you think that any of the lesbians who are your followers really want you to keep certain material just for them and to not kind of share that with the straight world?
I think so. I think that I call them trade secrets. I think that, yes, women sometimes get nervous, and I'm very cautious about what I say to a very mixed audience. You kind of build up a trust level and you find out how much they can hear, and you go from there.
Kate, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, dear.
Comedian Kate Clinton spoke with us from the NPR Bureau in Los Angeles. Her latest recording is Kate Clinton, live at the Great American Music Hall on Wisecrack Records. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
I understand the show's in stereo tonight.
It is, and it's in stereo especially for a report by Alex Chadwick, together with producer Art Silverman, that they did in Vietnam, and it's all about political freedom in that country. Where is the line drawn? What may you do, and what can you not do?
What else are you doing?
Well, we're following events in Panama, in Israel, where Demjanjuk was sentenced to the death penalty early today. Further developments in Lawrence Walsh, the special prosecutor in the Iran-Contra affairs case against North Sea Court Hakim and Poindexter.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A new television show about the war in Vietnam is premiering this Tuesday night on ABC. Television critic David Bianculli has a review.
The helicopters keep coming over the hills, dropping off more dead and wounded before returning to the battlefields. The doctors and nurses are suffering massive burnout. They've got blood on their scrubs and death in their dreams. The veterans hide behind wisecracks or silence to make it through, while the newcomers stare in disbelief. All this is wrapped up in a weekly TV series that, at times, can make you laugh loudly or cry quietly. So why am I reviewing MASH 5 years after it went off the air? I'm not. This is a review of a new series, China Beach, that premieres Tuesday night on ABC. Only two possible reasons can justify why ABC is presenting a drama about Vietnam and reminiscent of MASH in the same season that CBS got all that publicity for scheduling a Vietnam War series called Tour of Duty. Either ABC is stupid or China Beach is good. As it turns out, China Beach is good. It's got the same stock characters from a lot of war movies and TV shows. There's the weary veteran with only 1 week left before returning stateside. And the Joker, always on the prowl for sex or a good time. And finally, the wide-eyed innocent fresh to the war, equally amazed by the heroism and the horror. The difference, the big difference, is that in China Beach, all those characters are women. Dana Delaney stars as Colleen McMurphy, the nurse who's just about to complete her tour of duty. She's reminiscent of a character from MASH, but it's not Hot Lips, it's Hawkeye. Here she is at a local bar, quietly drinking to her last night in Vietnam, when a doctor finds her and describes the night's activity at the operating room.
Since you've gone off duty and are through duty, we got 6 sucking chest wounds sealed up with trash bags, 3 mix and matches from booby traps, and a new veggie for the vegetable patch. And you're in here feeling sorry for yourself.
Yes. The I am God doctor routine.
Mm-hmm.
You see a gunshot wound through and through. You see a third degree burn. There's not even a person attached to them. You'll cut off their hand, but you don't have to hold it.
There are some scenes in John Sackrett Young's script that don't ring true, but there are a lot more that do. And director Rod Holcomb makes China Beach the most cinematic, beautiful TV series since Frank's Place. The show's biggest strength, though, is its cast. Tour of Duty never really draws you into the characters or makes you care much about them. China Beach does. In the 2-hour pilot, the standout performance comes from Chloe Webb, the electrifying co-star of the film Sid and Nancy. She's guest starring as a man-hungry singer who visits the base. Also good, though, are Marge Helgenberger as a USO volunteer, whose duties have expanded to include sex for sale, and Michael Boatman as the camp coroner who, like the men in the field, is fighting a losing battle. And Delaney, as the short-timer heard earlier, is so good that you hate to see her go, and may not have to. But see for yourself. Tour of Duty, at times, is a duty to watch. China Beach, most of the time, is a pleasure.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Next time, I'll speak with Spanish film director Pedro Almodovar. His sex comedies and melodramas are big hits in Spain. He says, "My rebellion is to deny Franco. I refuse even his memory." Also, rock historian Ed Ward will look back at TK Productions, the Miami record company that fused Southern rhythm and blues with a disco beat. And book critic John Leonard will review Love in the Time of Cholera, the new novel from Nobel Prize winner Gabriel Garcia Marquez. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Fred Landrell. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Gavin Morrison and Carol Jewett. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.